have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover. We're all tired from being out later than usual last night.
Uh-huh. Yeah, usually we don't go partying on Friday night, but, well, I couldn't really avoid last night because we had a fundraiser for Eat the Steak that was also a roast of me for my 50th birthday. we had a great time. So thank you so much for all the people who organized that and turned out for it. And I'm really sorry that I spoiled the party by announcing my new lobbying career. But, we won't dwell on that. So thank you.
All right. Let's start out, as we always do, with the locals, starting out with the Seattle City Council.
Yeah, the Seattle City Council is finalizing their budget, and this week they made a couple of final decisions. One of them is something that I think is a big mistake. They repealed the city employee hours tax, which was a $25 per person tax on people who drive to work in Seattle that businesses had to pay once a year and remit to the city. The funds were dedicated strictly to the transportation budget, so it was a fair tax. It was like a user fee that taxed people who drive and then turned the money around to maintain the roads and other transportation infrastructures. But the city council voted, it was an 8-1 vote, with Richard McIver being the lone no vote, to repeal the tax. So that tax is now gone.
Yeah, and a couple quick things on that. Well, actually three, because also McGinn has said that he supported that tax,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
but he's not going to try and get it reinstated, I don't think. But this was a parting gift by Greg Nichols. It sort of gives the lie to his whole environmentalist sheen over the last several years, and it really shows how conservative the city council has become. It's going to be very interesting to see how they get along with McGinn.
Yeah, another move that they made this week was they voted to increase the city light rates by 13.8%. That was a much narrower 5-4 vote. The folks who voted for that were Tim Burgess, Gene Godden, Sally Clark, Richard Conlon, and Nick Licata. And those who voted against were Jan Drago, Richard McIver, Tom Harrell, and Tim Rasmussen. So that was interesting. I'd like to hear from some of those liberal folks on the council who usually have the interests of Seattle's working poor in mind when they're thinking about the budget. Why Sally Clark, for example, and Nick Licata would vote yes to increase city light rates by such a steep amount in a year when everybody's struggling to make ends meet. The city council did restore some of the funding to the Seattle Public Library, about $863,000, so that 11 branch libraries will be able to stay open 7 days a week. The remaining 15 branches, though, will be open only 5 days a week. And the city library budget will have about a $1.77 million shortfall, and the whole library system will still have to close down for 1 week next year. It's a trade-off there. They cut some taxes, some of the revenue flowing into the budget, and they fund some projects, but not all. So it might be good to go and ask them a few questions, or at least go and hear why they made the decisions they made. The city council has a press conference scheduled for noon on Monday on the third floor of the downtown public library building to go over the main points in their budget and why they decided to do what they did with the budget this year. So it might be a good time for folks to go and check it out and hear what they have to say.
All right. Moving on, it appears official that Mike McGinn is going to be our next mayor.
Yeah, no real surprise carrying over from last week. This time last week, the returns were certainly trending that way. But we found early this week, Joe Malahan officially conceded, which means, of course, that he can go back to doing whatever it was that Joe Malahan does. That was never really made clear during the campaign, which is probably why he's not mayor right now. But it's been a very interesting dynamic because, of course, all the movers and shakers on election night in Seattle are no longer movers and shakers. And so something interesting happened during the course of the week, which is that they all went to work for Dow Constantine in the county, starting with Tim Seiss, who... was the chief of staff for Greg Nichols for a number of years, got the nickname The Shark. He's actually been around for many years. He, I believe he worked for Norm Rice at one point, too. He goes back a number of years. He's going to be the chief of staff for Dow Constantine now. We also had Fred Jarrett, who ran against Constantine in the primary for the job of King County executive and who was the most conservative of the four Democrats running. He's a state senator. Well, he was a state senator because now he's going to become deputy executive under Constantine. So Constantine, who ran as being the most liberal of the four Democrats in that race, now is shaping up to, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, yes, it's a lot of insider politics and some of the same old business interests and somewhat disappointing on that score. On the other hand, if Susan Hutchinson were King County executive, she'd probably name as her chief of staff Barney the Purple Dinosaur. So it's, at least they're competent. Let's give it that.
Uh-huh.
All right. Moving on, it's Seattle Police Department saying they have caught their domestic terrorist.
Yeah, Christopher Monfort is the man who was accused on Halloween of killing, really in cold blood, an officer who was on patrol and wounding his trainee partner.
In a drive-by shooting.
In a drive-by shooting. And also, is also accused of an arson at the maintenance yard down by the stadiums, a few days previous to that. Was caught when they searched his apartment with, quote, homemade explosives, a military assault rifle, which is primarily homemade, and another firearm, and is being, characterized as, Mike mentioned, with being a domestic terrorist, which is really something of a stretch, since he certainly didn't issue any political demands. He just didn't like police, with prejudice, which is really unfortunate and obviously a fairly heinous crime. But there's really no sense, why call him a terrorist? That just poisons the well and really distorts the meaning of the term, I think. But at the same time, the media coverage of this has been so sensationalized, in part by use of that kind of language, that the trial of Paul Sheen, who was the King County deputy, who people may remember last year, was caught on camera assaulting a 15-year-old girl in her jail cell. Well, apparently, Monfort had literature from the October 22nd anti-police abuse activist group that talked about that case, and so therefore they postponed Sheen's trial. I'm not exactly sure why, but the whole thing is, well, he had this literature in his possession and therefore it must have inspired him and blah blah blah. It really casts a pall over anybody who has been critical of SPD or some of their abuse cases or some of the cases where, you know, there over the years where there have been officers, particularly white officers, shooting unarmed people of color. There have been real serious issues involving SPD over the years, and the fact that you've got this nut who's acting on his hatred because of those issues, or in part because of those issues, allegedly because of those issues, doesn't change the fact that there are issues. And we heard another one of those stories this week where SPD announced very quietly on a Friday news dump that they've started an internal investigation into the June arrest of a suspect by three officers. He actually came back to claim his evidence from a prior arrest. Daniel Saunders, age 46, had been arrested and jailed on June 6th for investigation of burglary and vandalism after he allegedly broke into a Near Valley church naked and covered with blood, which tells you that the guy probably has some mental health issues. Yeah, he was accidentally released when he shouldn't have been a couple days later. The following day, he went to the evidence unit to get property taken when he was booked into jail. They found that he had an outstanding warrant because he'd been released by mistake. They tried to arrest him, and apparently it took three officers who used their fists, their batons, a flashlight, and a taser. There's actually a video of this because it was captured by the surveillance camera at the evidence unit. They spent 2.5 minutes, which is actually a really long time when you think about it.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't a fight. It was them beating on him.
Yes.
It was incredibly one-sided, and for most of that time, there was at least one officer sitting on him. The guy was squirming, but he was clearly subdued. He was clearly not a threat.
clearly
and,
down, at least.
Yeah, and yeah. The other part of that video is the paramedics carrying him out motionless on a stretcher, which mm-hmm. kind of tells you what the end result of the process was. So, you put out videos like this, and you have incidents like this, and then people wonder why some folks don't like the police. It's a total mystery.
Why one of those folks who may himself have some mental health issues makes a homemade gun and uses it. So that's interesting. And the fact that then they can turn around and use that as an excuse to stop a trial where there was pretty clear police abuse, I find that an abuse in itself.
Absolutely.
All right, moving on to national and sticking with the theme of trials, trial coming up in New York.
Yeah, the Bush administration announced yesterday.
Obama administration.
Sorry, Obama.
How could you possibly get this confused?
Well,
You just keep walking them home.
Yeah. The Obama administration announced that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others who are being held at Guantanamo would now be brought to the United States for a civilian trial in New York City, just blocks from where 9/11 happened. Five others who are being held at Guantanamo are going to get a modified military tribunal. Well, I heard this and I had two reactions. First of all, can these five men, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, actually get a fair trial in New York City where 9/11 happened? And my answer to that is absolutely not. And
you know what the media coverage of that trial is going to
be like.
And even the advanced publicity of what's going on right now, you know the New York Post is running headlines that say something like hang them dry or something.
Yeah,
yes,
I think
exactly.
They're setting up the circus tents right now as we speak.
Yeah, exactly. And then my other response was, why military tribunals for the other five? I mean, clearly to me that says that they don't have enough evidence to convict him in a civilian court, so they're gonna try him in a military court and
they've got supporting evidence without the confessions that were elicited with the use of torture on behalf of the five that are going to New York, but they don't have that supporting evidence for the others, so they'll just talk about a kangaroo court.
Yeah, yeah. And this comes at the same time that White House counsel Greg Craig, Obama's leading legal counsel inside the White House, has announced that he's going to resign. Greg Craig has always been viewed as a Washington D.C. insider, the kind of guy who knows how to work the politics and how to deal with the Republicans and Democrats. He had worked for Bill Clinton during his presidency. And so and he was tasked with trying to do a 180 on a lot of really terrible Bush administration policies. So he had a hard job going into that position. He's come under a lot of fire, though, for not being able to get Guantanamo closed down and to get this whole thing straightened out within the one-year framework that Obama had announced when he became president. So, among other things, there were problems with vetting some of the folks who were going to join the Obama administration. There were questions about whether Craig and his team had done a sufficient job vetting some of the candidates, like Tom Daschle and Bill Richardson and some of the other folks that Obama had
Gary
announced.
Locke.
Yeah, that Obama had announced were going to join his team, and then they had to pull back. But what's disturbing about this announcement to me is that Obama has said he's going to appoint an insider, a man who worked on his campaign as legal counsel, who comes with him from Chicago as the replacement for Craig. And to me, that's an echo of what George Bush did when he gained the White House. He basically brought with him his legal team from Texas, and then they got busy and got to work sort of doing the best they could to gut the Constitution. So
yeah, that's how we got Harriet Myers and Alberto Gonzalez.
Oh, and Alberto Gonzalez, very definitely. So to me, that's not a good trend.
All right. Let's move from that to update on the Fort Hood shootings.
Yeah, not so much the update on the Fort Hood shootings themselves, but sort of the anatomy of a media smear that popped up this week. Actually, it was starting to make the rounds in the Wingnut media toward the end of last week. But the whole idea that Nidal Hassan was an Al-Qaeda operative, and the polite version of this is the meme making the rounds which you're still seeing in the media, that Hassan had contact with known Al-Qaeda fighters and so forth. This originally hit the mainstream media on Monday with a report leaked by senior American officials, quote unquote, that Hassan had contact with Al-Qaeda fighters. And what it turned out to be was a former imam at the mosque that Hassan went to when he lived in Northern Virginia, who had since moved to Yemen and was suspected of having ties to Al-Qaeda. But number one, he was also the former imam of Hassan, and in a totally non-political
role.
And that the correspondence that he had with him had been monitored by an intelligence agency, so it determined that in fact there was no political content to that it was, you know, pretty straightforward, the role of somebody who was seeking spiritual guidance from somebody who had been a spiritual mentor.
He'd been doing research too on
PTSD.
On PTSD, and he was also doing research on factions within the Muslim community and how folks who were Muslims might respond to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was part of his research when he was trying to finish his degree, was to contact imams and talk to them about, you know, who do you counsel and what do you tell them and that kind of stuff.
So you had the spectacle of people like Joe Lieberman, who is almost certainly the senior American official who was leaking this stuff, you know, him and Peter Hoekstra and some of the other conservative Republicans who were wanting to make the Obama administration look bad by, you know, intimating that here you had Al-Qaeda, you know, launching an attack on Fort Hood, that was the clear subtext to all of this, you know, suggesting that Hassan was getting his instructions from Al-Qaeda fighters, yada, 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 and there's simply no evidence to support any of that, but somehow it has made its way into the media, and it won't go away.
All right. Well, shortly after our show last week, I think the same day, the House health care reform bill was passed.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't really have a chance to look at all the details, but it's come out since then, in the weeks since then, that the abortion provision that was written into the House health care reform bill is actually much worse than we thought. It's
much worse.
Instead of simply saying that no federal dollars, which is already enshrined in federal law, that no federal dollars can go to fund abortion, it would also keep women from being able to buy insurance coverage for abortions with their own money. And here's how it would do that. It would say that even women who go to the new healthcare exchange and look for a policy that would be partially subsidized by federal money or federal tax rebate could not buy plans that would cover abortion. So
even if those plans were not subsidized by the federal government.
If those plans were not subsidized by the federal government, they'd be offered on the federal health care exchange, which would be funded with federal money. So in addition, women who get their health care through their employer, if the employer then decided to buy plans on the health care exchange, then those women might lose their abortion coverage. Folks who were looking at the bill said, well, God, you know, surely, you know, those women could, of course, buy their own rider on a policy with their own money. But how many women plan to pay for an unplanned pregnancy? I mean, nobody really plans to pay ahead of time for an unplanned pregnancy. So it simply becomes ridiculous.
About that?
Yeah, it really is. In fact, the conservative Democrats in the House who rejected compromise wording that is in the Senate bill that would have said, well, women can buy plans that are partially subsidized on the healthcare exchange, and then they can pay with their own money for the abortion coverage, and the federal money will go for other types of coverage. That compromise wording that's in the Senate bill is not in the House bill. The House Democrats rejected that. So that really shows how a few abortion extremists can swing the vote in their favor.
Yeah, and to give you an idea of how extreme and how out of sync with the sort of mainstream consensus on this issue some of these legislators are. Bart Stupak, the Democrat who is named after, this amendment is named after, and Pitts, his Republican colleague who co-sponsored the amendment with him, had also put forward a separate amendment this summer, which, would have denied coverage. There are exceptions in this particular case based on, you know, rape and incest, but in this, the amendment that was offered this summer by these same folks, they offered an amendment which would have forced women to prove that it was not only a rape but a forcible rape, a near rape. Like, what's the difference?
Yeah.
But
there is any difference.
The difference between the consensual rape and or you know, maybe the non-forcible rape is the statutory rape, and therefore if they're 10, they don't really deserve to be able to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. I mean, it shows
ridiculous.
How ridiculous and how extreme some of these lawmakers are. It's really very disturbing. The other unfortunate part of this is that because the margin was so small in the House passage of this bill, it really weakens the ability of the House bill to improve on what is likely to be a very conservative bill coming out of the Senate, not on this issue specifically, but on the overall arc of healthcare reform. So it's still up for question whether anything is going to be passed at all, but if something is passed, it's likely to be not nearly what we need.
All right, and briefly, Bill, on regarding needle exchanges.
Yeah, let me just find my notes on that here. Yeah, the bill to lift the ban on federal funding for needle exchanges was introduced in Congress, but this bill would do something else. I mean, it's good news on the one hand for needle exchanges, because many of them don't qualify for federal funding right now. But it would also impose a requirement that a needle exchange can't be within 1,000 feet of a school, a park, a library, a college, a video arcade, or anywhere where children might be. And this, unfortunately, of course, 1,000 feet, you might say, how far is that? Well, you know, that's quite a distance.
It's a fifth of a mile.
Yeah, and it would mean that a majority, if not all, of the nation's some 200 needle exchanges would not qualify for federal funding. And this comes at a time when many are closing down because of a lack of funding, and needle exchanges are needed more than ever. Some of them are seeing a doubling in the number of clients with a boost of heroin use in the U.S., particularly because, of course, we are engaging in a war in Afghanistan that is boosting the world supply of heroin to record levels.
Not to mention an intelligence agency that's probably funneling some of that heroin supply.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, and briefly, this week's economic news.
Yeah, a good bill, finally, on financial reform was introduced in the Senate this week. Senator Christopher Dodd, who is the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, introduced a bill that would go much further than the House bill and further even than the Obama administration has proposed in merging the bank, all four of the big banking regulators, into one new agency. It would do away with the Office of Thrift Supervision and the Office of the Comptroller, and it would cut the regulatory powers of the FDIC and the Federal Reserve. It would put it all together in one new agency. And more importantly, I think it would provide a dedicated funding source for the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it would give them the power to regulate derivatives, which have been largely unregulated up till now. And it would also make large hedge funds register and report their financial their financial operations. So it would go much further than anything we've seen so far. It's a good bill, and we're just going to have to see how that Senate bill, if it passes, gets reconciled with the much more watered-down House version.
All right, moving on to international and Pakistan.
Yeah, in Pakistan, there was a new article this week in the New Yorker by Seymour Hersh, and I always enjoy reading his articles. It's in the November 16th edition. It's called "Defending the Arsenal," and it makes very clear that Pakistan's nuclear the U.S. government really has no idea what Pakistan's provision for its nukes is, and that Pakistan doesn't trust us. They view us as an ally of India, and they view India as their sworn enemy, and that we will never know the actual truth of how many nukes Pakistan has, where they are, and how well they're secured.
And Israel, the West Bank?
Yeah, there was much talk this week about ending the January elections in that were supposedly going to be scheduled for the West Bank, at least, because, and Fatah blames that, the fact that the elections will be canceled, on the fact that Hamas will not come to an agreement on holding elections in the Gaza Strip. I think personally that Fatah declared a cease to the elections because they were afraid they weren't going to win.
What happened is their people fanned out across the West Bank trying to buy votes, and nobody would sell them to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody is so disgusted with Fatah giving in to the U.S. position and giving in to the Israeli position that they have no base of support anymore.
All right, and finally, Blackwater.
Yeah, it was announced this week that, well, actually it came out this week that Blackwater executives had paid $1 million in bribes to Iraqi officials so that they wouldn't get their operating permit yanked after employees shot and killed some 17 innocent Iraqi civilians in Baghdad in an incident in Nisour Square in September 2007. This is the incident that helped precipitate Blackwater getting, and many other contractors getting kicked out of Iraq. I thought that was an interesting piece of news this week.
All right, and events.
Yeah, several of them going on. Several things today. From 2 to 4 o'clock, there's a community tribunal to save the basic health care plan. That'll be at Rainier Community Center, 4638th Avenue South. 6 o'clock, the ACLU is having its annual dinner with Guantanamo attorney Jeff Robinson, who's probably pretty busy this week. Mm-hmm. That's going to be at the Seattle Marriott Waterfront Hotel. And also tonight, at 8 and 9 o'clock, the Veterans for Peace is sponsoring folk singer George Mann with a CD release party at Not a Number. Sets at 8 or 9 o'clock. Not a Number, our friends at 1905 North 45th Street in Wallingford. And then tomorrow, as you heard earlier in the program, from 7 to 9 p.m., Ray McGovern will be speaking again. He was in Seattle earlier this week, and tomorrow night he'll be at UW-Tacoma at Carwine Auditorium, 1900 Commerce Street in Tacoma. And once again also, thank you for folks who turned out for the Eat the State benefit last night. The next thing on our plate is a WTO issue that's coming up in a couple weeks. So if you have stories to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the WTO protests or thoughts on where the global justice and climate change movements go from here, send them in to editorial at eatthestate.org.
Or a potential job opening for Lou Dobbs.
Yeah. I hear he's looking right now. Maybe he'll run for president.
Yeah, maybe he'll run on a ticket
of Mexico
with Sarah Palin.
Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in places where you find free periodicals, like bookstores, cafes, bars, restaurants, and other places where you find free stuff. And
pet stores.
Yes, we can be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org.